This is Jeff Spittler, April 28th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 67, The Killing Times, Part 1. Okay, well, I am glad to be back, even if I didn't bring you any chocolates. 2 weeks ago, we covered the events which followed the execution of Donald Cargill. Cargill's execution left the Covenanters without any field preachers to speak of. And they formed themselves into societies, which in turn formed a larger organization, the United Societies. We discussed some of their meetings and so on. The Parliament passed an act anent religion in the test, creating a test oath, which according to one commentator was so contradictory that it was generally considered that he took it implied that he was Presbyterian, Episcopalian, and Roman Catholic all at once. Okay, the test act, or test oath, was applied to people in almost any position of authority in Scottish society, you know, all the way down to, say, family chaplains and so on. Even so, from the highest to the lowest, there were people who refused to take it. There were the members of Parliament, or of Parliament and the Privy Council, who refused to take it, members of the indulged clergy and Episcopal curates who refused to take it. But, as you will see today, I think, the idea of the Test Act goes even further and deeper into society so that everyone's required to take an oath. We went on to cover various incidents of persecution in an anecdotal manner, and we left off in May of 1683 with Claverhouse having been appointed to the Privy Council. So, a few more incidents, and then we'll move on to some other things. In June of 1683, Alexander Gordon of Earlston was arrested. Earlston, along with John Nisbet, and Nisbet's the father of the boys that I mentioned 2 weeks ago now, they were part of the United Societies. They had been commissioned to go to the continent to represent their case to the Reformed churches there. He'd been back, and he was leaving the country again when he was arrested at Newcastle the night before he was to sail for Holland. He dropped a packet of papers into the sea, but they were fished out. And from Hewison's account, oh yes, the papers. Their tenor could not be misinterpreted. And this is quoting from the papers. After they have dispatched the old cotton stuff, they will then think of what new commodities will be best. Old cotton stuff, CS, was a designation of the king, right, Charles Stuart, as appropriate as it was comical. Here was inkling of a plot. The prisoners were hurried off to London. The king had ordered their examination in Scotland. For the first time, the government seemed to realize that the Cameronians held meetings who kept life in their schism. In Edinburgh, nothing was disclosed by the examination of Earlston, who asserted that his papers were harmless church and business documents. The council distrusted the apparent ingenuineness of Earlston and resolved at having him tortured, which was an illegal act in the case of a man already condemned. Authority from the king was craved, and as the Lord Advocate Mackenzie was at court, and on being consulted, was of opinion that torture to expiate new matter was legal, the necessary order was sent to the examiners. To influence and make Earlston a little more communicative, his execution was announced for the 28th of September. Several reprieves were granted to him. On the 25th of September, the inquisitors sat, and into their presence were brought Earlston, the hangman, and the boots, with the desired result that the accused promised to give the fullest assistance in interpreting his papers. He had previously accused General Delisle, Drummond, and others, not without being suspected of having been suborned by intriguers at home. And when his examination produced no startling revelations, the counselors were not satisfied. Fresh instructions arrived ordering torture. News of the intention unnerved Earlston. On the 23rd November, the council met. Obviously received a reprieve. Claverhouse among the number to put Earlston in the boots. With difficulty brought to the torture chamber, Earlston, on being ordered to the boots, rose in fury, roared out like a bull, and being in his prime, like a shaggy Galloway, tossed maesters and soldiers about the chamber to the dismay of his tormentors. The counselors imagined that he was shamming, but four physicians certified that the trouble of the distracted covenanter was alienatio mentis, furor latent laborans. What's that?
He was really mad.
Yeah. He was really mad. They recommended for him the fresh air of the Castle Rock, and there he was sent and kept till April, when he was brought down to the foul toll booth again. He petitioned for the benefit of the air of the rock. The council gratified him with a fortnight stay on the Bass Rock in August. On his return to the toll booth, he made a futile attempt to escape, for which he was loaded with irons. In these, he was transmitted to the Castle of Blackness in September, where again he petitioned for air and to be relieved of his irons. In the damp fortress he lay till January 1689, when he was liberated before Donald Kerr of Kersland, leader of a rabbling party, could demand his release from a not inconsiderate governor. Earlston always asseverated his loyalty to the crown and even prayed for his majesty's health, but no excuses or defenses availed with the suspicious authorities. Let's see, in July, numerous men suspected of sympathizing with the Covenanters, and whose names therefore were on lists called the Porteous Rolls, were called into court to take the required to take the test. 36 were sent to prison on the 24th of July, 54 on the 25th, 22 on the 30th, and on the 25th, an additional 21 who did not appear were forfeited and put to the horn. So Hewison says the prisons were filled to overflowing by sufferers, gentle and simple without distinction, to whom the prospect of transportation was the only relief which came to mitigate the brutality of their treatment. Right, that would be transportation to the colonies. By now, the Carolinas seemed to be the preferred place where they could get 10 pounds per person from the slave market. The most extraordinary and almost incredible statement of Wodrow, that the authorities deliberately deserted a great many processes for sodomy, adultery, murder, theft, etc., to permit the council and lords of justiciary to take up the more remunerative cases of gentlemen inheritors for whom there was no accommodation in the prisons, is true. A reference to the Book of Ed Journal shows that on 12th November 1683, 21 such criminal charges were departed from. The godly were stuffed into noisome cells, the vilest felons were emancipated in order to lurk around like ghouls and commit those crimes for which there was no cause traceable by the law officials, at least beyond the covenant. And of course, when you let go all these people, as they continue to prey on society, but you can always blame it on the covenanters, is what the government did. Skipping a little bit here. He says, the objection of Chancellor Aberdeen to the punishing of the heads of families for the delinquencies of their dependents, a hardship less grievous than the taking children as hostages for their parents, as approved of by the king, led to his being suspected of weakness and his fealty and to his ultimate displacement. Public life was rotten to the core, and every man's hand was turned against his neighbor. But it does get worse. So. One bright spot in September 1683, this is in addition to two Covenanters who were condemned to death, escaped from the Canongate toll booth. Another bright spot was the return from Holland of James Rennick, who had been studying there, and he was ordained by Dutch ministers. Much like Cameron, he came back to lift the standard in Scotland again. He'd been born in February of 1662 to a weaver and his wife in Dumfriesshire. All right, this was one of the hotbeds of covenanting. According to Hewison, Rennick was old enough in November of 1666 to remember seeing Sir James Turner, who had been captured by some of the covenanters, marched out of the Glencairn Church. Likewise, old enough to remember seeing some of the same covenanters skulking in the glens after they'd been beaten at Rolyon Green. Rennick graduated from the University of Edinburgh in 1681. According to Hewison, Rennick accepted the royal indemnity and took the bond, though he was very sympathetic to the persecuted Covenanters. But 7 weeks later, seeing Cargill executed so moved him that he resolved to fight and die for liberty. He became active in the United Societies, and as I mentioned before, he was present at the Lanark Declaration. In October 1682, the Society sent him to Holland as a pastoral candidate for further training. And they apparently sent other men there also. I'm not sure what became of them. Studied there, and after a prolonged examination of Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and theology, obtained ordination from the classes of Groningen after the Presbyterian Forum on the 10th of May, 1683. According to J.D. Douglas, he was ordained there despite the fact that he had declined to sign their formularies and had protested against their church's corruptions. I guess that's no surprise there. A little bit more on Rennick. On the 3rd of October, the general meeting, this would be of the United Societies, was held at Darmead, Lanarkshire, and at it Renwick compared, or he appeared, handed in his presbyterial certificates and testimony or confession of his principles and opinions on the controversies of the time, after which he received a call to be minister to the remnant. A great multitude assembled at the same place on the 23rd of November to hear his first public lecture and sermon in the fields, when he discoursed on Cargill's last theme, comfort ye my people, and on Isaiah 26:20. Thus began his vagabond ministry, in which one of the most important coadjutors was a fleet fresh horse standing bridled at his hand. All the righteous did not rally to his flag. The superfine splitters of hares who paid customs at boats and bridges but refused to pay them at ports and markets did not own him. Other Puritans withdrew on the ground that he was ordained by those who had the organs, an evident slander. Still others distrusted him, attributing his hairbreadth escapes to being a spy and a Jesuit priest. Read that. I mean, that's partly when people are, you know, extremely persecuted, I think these sort of suspicions. There were a lot of spies, so tends to make people suspicious. Nevertheless, after the return of Rennick, there was a recrudescence of disaffection and of conventicles. Hundreds of admirers brought their children to him for baptism. Let's see, skipping ahead here, Rennick, he was endowed with a rapturous poetic spirit like Rutherford's, with which a refined, pure mind and clear judgment so restrained that he was never led into excess of zeal, either in writing or in action. The letters of this simple peasant, for grace, elegance of diction, and delicacy of feeling, are comparable with the best productions of his age, and afford a striking contrast to the miserable, vulgar, ill-spelled compositions of the fashionable hacksters who hunted the rebels to death. So we can leave open the question of how Hewison would know that the other guys were ill-spelled. His hereditary instincts of piety and morality became his native source of strength when he found and acknowledged Christ for himself, and standing on the rock of salvation exclaimed, "Let us be lions in God's cause and lambs in our own." He fully realized the responsibility of his office and the end of his mission. "Oh, to be framed," quoting him, "oh, to be framed for the work of the day. If I give the ark a wrong touch, it will be through blindness, not through biasedness. The shadow of his cross preceded him in all his weary pilgrimage, forcing him to say, "I am daily looking out either to be presently killed or else dragged into a prison or scaffold." He had no fear. His testimony to the Reformed Church and faith, he vowed, he would seal with his blood. Rennick had not that body of the flesh whose possession Captain Peyton lamented, being but a fragile, bodiless soul, more a phantom than a suffering man carried about by others. It was natural to him thus to express his yearnings: "Death to me is as a bed to the weary," and to offer himself a reconciling sacrifice. "If my blood were a means to procure that end, I would willingly offer it." Influenced by these principles and aspirations, this pure herald of the cross and champion of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland could not countenance the workers of iniquity, regal, lay, or ministerial. Okay, by the spring of 1683 went out much like it had come in, with three Covenanters in New Monkland, Dalserf, and Lesmahagow being sentenced to death. Their answers to the charge of being having arms at Drumclog and Bothwell, approving of Archbishop Sharp's death and refusing to say "God save the King" without some reservations, were unsatisfactory, and so they were condemned to death. One of the men being executed, a man named Cochrane, leaving behind a wife and six children, said, of his prison and this irons that he was chained in. That was no discouragement to me, for when the storm blew hardest, the smiles of my Lord were at the sweetest. It is a matter of rejoicing unto me to think how the Lord hath passed by many a tall cedar and hath laid his love upon a poor bramble bush the like of me. Hewison says, all died in peace, the only peace in troubled Scotland. Okay, by the spring of 1684, the prisons were now so crammed full of people that the council petitioned the king and got consent to transport many of the less obnoxious prisoners, they called penitents, to the American plantations. Batches of them were consigned to Walter and James Gibson, who sailed the ship the Carolina Merchant from Greenock in midsummer. I think I've actually got notes here, but they later then were sold them in the Carolina slave markets. In April, Claverhouse equipped a ring of blockhouses, right, a series of forts, not very necessarily large ones, but blockhouses around southwest Scotland, and then boasted, now that the troops are posted, I shall answer for the peace and good order of all these countries, which in a manner is all the fanatic part of the kingdom. He was further aided in May of 1684 by government proclamation, giving a list of fugitives to be arrested, 1,956 in total, including 16 ministers and 12 women. Claverhouse was married in Paisley on Tuesday, the 10th of June. Unfortunately for him, there was word of an armed conventicle led by James Rennick on the 8th of June. It reached him just about the time of his wedding, and he had to saddle up right after the ceremony and ride for 3 days looking for them unsuccessfully. I think he got even later, though. But on the 15th of July, a letter from the Privy Council to the King advised him that there is no security in complying with turbulent, disaffected people, it being truly easier, nobler, and safer to disable your enemies than to flatter them. A week later, the council was examining two prisoners, Arthur Tykett and Patrick Walker. Okay, Walker, we mentioned previously, as having later written a number of accounts of the Covenanters, and I have this rare-bound photocopy of Six Saints of the Covenant that he wrote. But he was also, we introduced him, he was a teenager who shot one of the king's soldiers. Tykett had been at Bothwell Bridge. The council ordered up the boots, but were informed that they would break his spindly legs, so they switched to thumbikins, thumb screws, which were invented by one of the bishops there. Tykett confessed to having been at Bothwell Bridge and of hearing James Rennick in conventicles. I think they already knew that, but that was enough to receive the death sentence. Walker escaped torture because Malik, the slave master who sold the prisoners in Carolinas, thought he could be sold for a good profit. So, in the event, though, he was imprisoned for 14 months, questioned 18 times, sentenced to banishment, but later escaped from the Leith toll booth in August of 1685. One minor bright spot occurred a week later on the 29th of July. General Delisle had been ordered to transport a group of prisoners from Dumfries to Edinburgh, where they were to sail for the Carolinas. Delisle sent a Lieutenant Patrick Mulligan in command of half a troop of horse, and the prisoners were tied in pairs of the horses. 6 miles east of Sanquhar, in a narrow and remote mountain pass, the command of soldiers found themselves surrounded by three groups of armed men. Hewison says on either side there was a party. Looking backward, he saw in Glen Valentine a third command barring his retreat. The ambuscade was perfect. There was a demand for the prisoners, a refusal, a dragoon's oath, a volley, the unerring shot of Black McMichael. Note this, the Fowler of Maxwellton, another duck hunter. And the tumbling dead of Sergeant Kelt into the Lynn, which tradition is named after him. The horses bolted in the confusion, some prisoners escaped. One assailant or prisoner, Robert Smith, was killed. Grierson was left for dead among the brackens, but survived. Word spread that one or two soldiers had been killed. And as you can probably, there was one killed, I'm not sure if there were two or not, but as you can probably guess, this was considered to be yet another outrage by the government. They followed this up with a major investigation where they sort of wormed out the the basic scheme. Claverhouse, with, quote, his usual luck, stumbled across six men sleeping in a field on the 9th of August, who appeared to be part of the Interkin ambush. And that's, I'm not sure if I said that, is a pass of Interkin. On the 15th of Edinburgh, they were tried. On the 15th of August, they were tried in Edinburgh for being in arms, and that one of them presented a gun to the king's forces, denied authority, and fled from the Majesty's forces. Three soldiers testified that they had been at Interkin. They were tried at noon, found guilty, and condemned to die between 2 and 5 o'clock. They were hung in the grass market that afternoon. On the 1st of August, after word of the Interkin rescue had reached Edinburgh, the Privy Council ordered up reports on the prisoners that were overflowing the prisons. And the reason for doing this is that it may be recommended to the justices to proceed and pronounce sentence of death against them immediately, which sentence they are to cause execute within 6 hours after pronouncing it, or within 3 hours in Glasgow and Dumfries. So, let's see, on the 6th of September, the council set up 4 circuit justiciary courts. And these courts went about much of southwest Scotland. These courts received 28 definite instructions as to disarming and finding non-jurors, licensing horses, sending in unlicensed preachers, punishing conventiclers, and for women their husbands, enrolling fugitives, examining indulged ministers, ferreting out inciters to rebellion, apprehending peddlers without passes, searching letter carriers, interviewing penitent rebels, ordering military, evicting the wives and families of forfeited and fugitive who do not clear themselves by oath that they have not conversed with their relatives, rendering account of quartering and fining, hunting down fugitives, suffering only loyal gentlemen to bear arms and no yeomen to travel 3 miles without a pass, offering the oath of allegiance, and banishing men and women refusing to take it, examining anyone regarding his loyalty, and, quote, you shall put in execution the power of justiciary to be granted unto you by our Privy Council with all rigor, by using fire and sword, as is usual in such cases. And we do empower our Privy Council to insert an indemnity to you, or any employed by you, for what shall be done in the execution thereof. That's a little unclear, but I guess that's Charles's commission to the Privy Council, which is then passed on to these justiciary courts. The commission was to endure till the 1st December, unless we think fit to prorogate the same. And as if the mesh and the judicial net were not small enough, ship captains were ordered to proffer the oath, test oath, to all passengers, and no traveler was permitted to leave one jurisdiction for another without a magisterial permit. Okay, well, as bad as the persecution had been to date, it got worse. Patrick Walker dated the killing times from the 15th of August, 1684, the date of the execution of the Interkin rescuers. Shields dated them from the death of Charles II in February 1685. So right just within a few, you know, few month period here, 6 month period. There may be, you know, it's probably difficult to put an exact definition of the killing times, but you might note that most of the executions to date have been done under the cover of law with a trial and judge and justice and so on. And then very shortly now, they'll be done with sort of on the spot with one man being detective, judge, jury, and executioner. But at the when the Interkin rescuers, the ones who had caught by Claverhouse, were executed, there was two people in the crowd that they caught out. One had just muttered something about these cows of Bashan or something like that, referring to the executioners, and refusing to take the test oath and so on. He was condemned to death and was killed a week later. So, okay, the justiciary courts began their work in the fall of 1684. One of the courts held in Glasgow had a sermon given by a Dr. Ross, in which his text was Agrippa's reply to Paul, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." There's some obvious parallels between the Covenanters and Paul and Agrippa in the justiciary courts. I make this kind of humorous, but the Glasgow court alone sent 1,200 people to prison. Again, quoting Hewison, consequently, the site was common of gangs of miserable, bedraggled prisoners, heritors, those are landowners, ministers, men, women, and even children, without distinction, being driven like bestial beasts by pitiless soldiery through wintry tempests from the state prisons into far Dunanatar, when some overdriven did not return. Glasgow prison was so overcrowded for 20 days that prisoners had to take turnabout and lying down. Justice had passed into insanity when Nithsdale women were tried for succoring a woman at the birth of a child of an Inverkin rescuer. Other courts were held in Ayr, Tinron, Dumfries, Kirkcaldy, Wigtown, Berwick, Roxburgh, and Peebles at the least. Those are records are preserved for those. Local ministers provided lists of persons fanatically inclined. And besides sentencing people to prison, significant numbers were also sentenced to transportation to the colonies, where they were sold as slaves. Augmenting the justiciary courts were a horde of flies, as they referred to them, informers and spies. And we've talked before about, you know, rewards for informers and so on. One contemporary recorded, at Privy Council, one Mr. William Houston is brought up by the soldiers as a field preacher with Rennick. But, it is said, he discovered himself to the Chancellor to be a Benedictine monk and showed his commission, commissioned to be a spy. So he was passed over in silence. Payden, who, we say there were no field preachers, right? And then there's this Alexander Payden who did preach some. He spent quite a bit of time in Ireland in disguise and so on. So I'm not sure how, he was in Scotland some, but not continuously. He observed someone forcing himself through the crowd to the front of a conventicle, and you recall that he sometimes called the prophet of the covenant. He said, "Here comes the devil's rattlebag." The guy that he was talking to was an informer. Talking about was an informer. Okay, so it wasn't merely the courts, but a raft of informers and spies that drove the Covenanters then to make another proclamation, apparently decided upon by a convention of the United Societies. It was published, I say published, by nailing it to doors, market crosses, and the like, on the 8th of November, 1684. It's called either the Apologetical Declaration or the Society People's Declaration, especially against informers and intelligencers. Couldn't actually find a copy of the whole thing. I found various quotes from it and a sort of a lengthy abstract, but this one leaves out the fact that one important statement, which is that they condemn executing judgment on people in a private manner. Okay, so they're, as you'll see, they're basically threatening to do that, but they want it to be done in some kind of judicial manner. Okay, so this is taken from actually from Rennick's copy, which was in the possession of Wadrow, the historian. From preventing further mistakes anent our purposes, we do hereby jointly and unanimously testify and declare that as we utterly detest and abhor that hellish principle of killing all who differ in judgment persuasion from us, it having no bottom upon the word of God or right reason. Okay, and some turns out later historians, some said that that's what the Covenanters wanted, was to kill people who didn't agree with them. Okay, here they go, they utterly abhor that. So we look upon it as a duty binding upon us to publish openly unto the world that forasmuch as we are firmly and really purpose not to injure or offend any whomsoever, but to pursue the ends of our covenants, and standing to the defense of our glorious work of reformation and of our own lives. Yet, we do hereby declare unto all that whosoever stretches forth their hands against us while we are maintaining the cause and interest of Christ against his enemies in the defense of our covenant of reformation, by shedding our blood actually, either by authoritative commanding, such as bloody counselors, bloody we say, insinuating clearly by this and other adjective epithets, an open distinction betwixt the cruel and bloodthirsty and the more sober and moderate, especially that so-called justiciary, generals of forces, adjutants, captains, lieutenants, and all in civil and military power who make it their work to imbrue their hands in our blood, or by obeying such commands, such as bloody militiamen, malicious troopers, soldiers, and dragoons. Likewise, such gentlemen and commons who, through wickedness and ill will, ride and run with the foresaid persons to lay search for us, or who deliver any of us into their hands, to the spilling of our blood by enticing morally or stirring up enemies to the taking away of our lives, such as designedly and purposely advise, counsel, and encourage them to proceed against us to our utter extirpation, by informing against us wickedly, wittingly, and willingly, such as viperous and malicious bishops and curates, and all sorts of intelligencers who lay out themselves to the fusion of our blood, together with all such as in obedience to the enemies, their commands, at the sight of us raise the hue and cry after us. Yea, and all such as comparing before the adversaries their courts, upon their demands delate us and any who befriend us to their and our extreme hazard and suffering. It's a long list of enemies there. We say all and every one of us shall be reputed by us enemies to God in the covenanted work of reformation and punished as such according to our power and the degree of their offense. Okay, and at this point the Dickinson and Donaldson put in an ellipsis and then go on. Now let not any think that, our God assisting us, we will be so slack-handed in time coming to put matters in execution as heretofore we have been, seeing we are bound faithfully and valiantly to maintain our covenants in the cause of Christ. Therefore let all these foresaid persons be admonished of their hazard, and particularly all ye intelligencers, who by your voluntary informations endeavor to render us up into the enemies of their hands, that our blood may be shed. For by such courses you both endanger your immortal souls, if repentance prevent not, seeing God will make inquisition for shedding the precious blood of his saints, whether be the thoughts of men, and also your bodies, seeing you render yourselves actually and maliciously guilty of our blood, whose innocency the Lord knoweth. And another ellipsis. So, it's not the whole thing, and I think you get the general flavor of it. I've seen other quotes from it in summaries that... basically, they're threatening to execute judgment on these other, on the people that are persecuting them. The declaration worried a number of informers and curates. Right, some fled. The government saw it as yet another provocation to be met by ratcheting up the persecution. On the 22nd of November, they voted to punish anyone who owns or does not disown the late traitorous declaration upon oath, right, who either owns it or refuses to disown it, whether they have arms or not, should be immediately killed before two witnesses. Okay, so no trial, just, you know, will you own this or will you take this oath, right? Well, they had to have an oath to that end. It's the abjuration oath, which I blank do hereby abhor, renounce, and disown in the presence of the Almighty God the pretended declaration of war lately affixed at several parish churches insofar as it declares a war against His Sacred Majesty and asserts that it is lawful to kill such as serve His Majesty in church, state, army, or country or such an act against the authors of the pretended declaration. I blank disown the villainous authors thereof, etc. Right, so as Hewison points out, that oath made it swear own the church to be a department of the state, right? The servants of His Majesty in church, state, army, or country. Okay, initially this was offered to suspects, right? And if they didn't take it, they should be killed on the spot. But by the end of the year, the council passes an act commanding all living south of Tay, right, to assemble and take the oath renouncing the declaration and its principles, so as to get a certificate of free pass, which is held indispensable for all travelers over 16 years of age. It forbade keepers of inns and lodgings to shelter people without passes, and empowered them to examine holders of suspicious passes, and offered them a reward of 500 merks for the discovery leading to the conviction of a society man. So, and then on the 9th of January, 1685, they went even further, requiring magistrates of boroughs to assemble parishioners on a parish-by-parish basis and require them to take the abjuration oath. They set up a commission to oversee this, and their instructions included the following gem. if any person owns these principles or does not disown them, they must be judged by at least three. And you must immediately give them a libel in the names of the inquest and witnesses. And they, being found guilty, are to be hanged immediately upon the place according to law. But at this time, you are not to examine any women, but such as has been active in these courses in a single manner, and these are to be drowned. And that was the legal basis for the drowning of the two Margarets at Wigtown. And let's see, about this time Claverhouse fell out of favor at court due to a rivalry with the Earl of Queensberry. Queensberry had some influence with the Duke of York and got an order calling up all the fines that Claverhouse had collected, which was pretty hard on the guy because he had been, living off these fines, a reprimand and removal from the Privy Council. Other officers were promoted over Claverhouse, and he had nothing to fall back on to win back his former respect, except, unfortunately, for the Covenanters' diligence in his job. Okay. 9th of February, 1685, Charles died. And just a real short account of his death that I haven't looked into this too closely, but there was one writer said that basically on on one Saturday, Charles was at this grand party with all his concubines and people playing cards with 2,000 pounds in gold on the table and all this, fine food and everything. And a week later, he was dead. So that was it was all dust. So at the close of his mortal illness, Archbishop Sancroft and Bishop Ken came to give ghostly counsel, to adjure the dying sinner to repent and to offer him the sacrament. The sweet voice of Ernest Ken availed nothing, and the king politely declined the sacrament, saying it was time enough. On their retirement, York asked his brother if he preferred a priest, and he assented. Huddlestone, a Benedictine priest, was at hand and was introduced by a private stair into the death chamber. Charles received his old friend with joy and exclaimed, "You that saved my body has now come to save my soul." A grateful reference to Huddleston's services at Worcester. In the words of York, Charles made his confession to him, was reconciled, received the blessed sacrament, had the extreme unction, and died unconcerned as become a good Christian. Yeah. Now this is, you'll see often that people say that Charles was a secret Catholic. And is probably the best basis of it. Of course, it is also true that the Duke of York was a Catholic, his brother, and maybe had reason to tell this story. So, this acceptance of the viaticum was not the mere perfunctory, timid recognition of the Church of Rome by a dying man, for the act was in accord with the king's long-concealed opinion regarding popery. His brother, again the Duke of York, attested two papers written by the late King Charles II of blessed memory, which he vouched for as found in the king's strongbox, written in his own hand. Therein Charles avowed his belief that there is one church, that none can be that church but that which is called the Roman Catholic Church. Some of these things are a little murky, but I mean, certainly wouldn't be surprising, but I think it's probably more likely true that Charles was just a libertine. Whether or not he was really, I doubt that he was a sincere Roman Catholic either. And of course, on his death then, James II, who was the Duke of York, a professed Roman Catholic, was proclaimed king. And that, depending on your accounting, either that may have ushered in the killing times also. Okay, well, we will stop there, and we're now very close to the end, depending on how many tales of persecution we tell. But questions?
Why was there a distinction made between the hanging of men and drowning of women?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, they used to drown witches, too, but I don't know the...
I'm not sure what the basis for that. I wouldn't be surprised to find it had some superstitious basis, but because remember this was still very much the era of witch hunting and all that, a lot of superstition in Scotland. But whether or not that had anything to do with it, I really don't know. But that's
like.
The question was, were there any safe havens in Scotland where people could go where they wouldn't have to worry about being persecuted? It's a good question. People, of course, didn't tend to travel as much in some respects. But most of the persecution was in southwest Scotland, where most of the Covenanters were. So, had they gone to Aberdeen, I don't know what would have happened, or if they would have just been suspected there. It's a good question, but I don't. Yeah, well, some people did go to, say, the Netherlands or Holland. Some tried to go to the colonies, to emigrate. Some went to, say, London, where they kind of got lost in the crowds. But by and large, I'm not sure that for most of them there was any route of escape. You can see now already that they would have had to have had passports and so on to travel. So it would have been rather difficult, to say the least.
Let's face it, there wasn't a whole lot of stuff for travel in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Bruce?
And the folks that were sold as slaves to the Carolinas. Whatever became of those slaves?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's going to take some further historical research. Some did actually come back to Scotland. That's the only sort of anecdotal.
They were actually slaves, not just indentured servants. They had a certain period.
Yeah. Well, Hewison and others refer to them just as slaves. I don't know if they were really slaves or they were really indentured servants, but they were sold on the slave market, which... I think indentured servants was usually sort of a contractual thing, right? These were not... they didn't have any place to negotiate from, so...
It's possible we could... some of us could be descendants of slaves.
That's right. Would we be eligible for reparations then? I don't know. From Scotland, we could claim... Well, we'll have to look into this, I think. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's stop there then.